spent my year abroad in a Latin American country in Peru, which is where I fell in love with Spanish, and I also did I had my first taste of translation there. I ended up doing some voluntary translation for a very strange artist who wrote terrible poetry. It was a good experience in that I haven't done it before. I got to work very closely with an author. I also got to learn about how you might want to choose more carefully the text that you work on. You don't want to end up doing extreme editing at the other end. And after I graduated, I worked as a bookseller for a couple of years in a foreign language bookshop, which doesn't exist anymore. It got subsumed. It was called Grant and Cutler, and it got subsumed by Foyles in central London. And I did a bit of translation there as well, actually. I used to translate the blurbs on the back of Spanish language books for our catalogue. And it was while I was working there that I heard about the Poetry Translation Centre workshop. So these still exist. It's a really good, if you're able to get to London. They start relatively early on, I think it's a Tuesday evening, so you can get the train down from Coventry with not too much difficulty. And they are multilingual group workshops which work on the translations of poetry from Asia, from Latin America, and from Africa. So it tends to be various Asian languages, but then Portuguese, Spanish, and French. And the way that it works is that somebody who speaks one of those languages will come along with the original translation, they'll bring a literal version of the poem, and then as a group, even if you don't speak the language, you work together to produce a more literary version of that literal version. There's somebody who leads the session, so there is guidance, but it's a really interesting way to get a sense of group translation, different ideas, different people's notions of vocabulary, depending on their age, their background, where they're from. And I met someone at these workshops who had attended the University of East Anglia's summer school, the BCLT summer school, which some of you might have heard of. This is another really good organisation to get involved with if you can, the British Centre for Literary Translation, which was based at the University of East Anglia. It's now based at Writers' Centre Norwich, although the summer school still runs on the UEA campus. It's not hugely cheap, but they have got some bursary, so if you're able to make the time to go, then I really recommend it. It's an incredible experience.
Can you explain to them how it works?
So it's a series of different language workshops, and each workshop contains an author and a translator, so you have direct access to this author, which is relatively rare, I would say. You might have email contact with them when you're already working on the book, but this is an author in the room. They can't escape. You can ask them all the questions you like, really probe them. One author who attended one day ended up having nightmares about her brain being sliced like a piece of meat because it was so intense, the grilling that she received from the workshop attendees. So you'll have an author in the room, you have a professional translator, and then a small group. It's never this big. It's normally between 8, 10, possibly maximum 15 people, and you all work on a short section of text. It might be a poem, it might be an extract from a play, it might be a part of a novel. And over the week, you thrash that translation out as a group, and then you also attend seminars, discussions, panel talks, and lectures the rest of the day with publishers, with other translators, with other authors, with translation academics. And it's a really intensive kind of crucible to give you a taste of what working as a translator might be like and how that world feels like. It's also nice and informal, so you'll end up talking about translation contracts or a certain literary approach over a sandwich and a glass of wine with a publisher. So it sort of takes away the difficult side of networking, because you don't feel like you're networking, you're all placed in that scenario together. UEA also runs a master's in literary translation, which is what I did after having attended the summer school. It was during the master's that I met the future publisher of the Mexicans book, so Stefan Tobler, who runs And Other Stories, which are a great independent publisher who publish really, really good fiction and translation. They're also very, very receptive to pitches from translators. And they run a series of reading groups to bring untranslated books to the attention of the publisher. So anyone can set up a reading group. There are already some in existence. But if you speak a language, for example, that hasn't been translated, then you're free to set up a reading group. You can discuss books within that reading group. You can produce samples that you maybe talk to other people in the group about, and the books that are the best slowly rise to the top. It's a kind of nice democratic filtration process. And Stefan has the ultimate say, but it's a very, they're very easy publisher to have a conversation with if you have a book that you want to talk about. Let me, more easy than some of the larger publishers out there. And I worked on a couple of short co-translations while I was doing the Masters with a translator called Anne McLean, and we've ended up collaborating on two or three books. Things kind of snowballed from there. It was a combination of luck, being in the right place at the right time, and being quite stubborn and tenacious.
You're very good at what you do.
Oh, thank you so
much. I can
say
that.
I will say the same for you.
Shall I? I'll move on, because Ross was one of the first people I called. So what I was just going to add to this was that translation is often thought of as a solitary activity, but I've tried to argue this, that it's the opposite. That firstly on a professional basis, but really also the activity itself. So often people talk about, you know, don't you get a bit sort of lonely sitting in your office, which is actually my dining room, you know, my living room, all day by yourself with a book, and you don't talk to anyone. And I said, well, if I'm not talking to someone, then there's a big problem, because I am talking all day to the book, to the author, and to other translators about whether or not my translation of this particular line, or even word, or whether a comma should be there is the right way to go about it, or one good way to go about it. So it's not a lonely profession, I wouldn't say, but it's helpful to be kind of sociable and not to be sort of, the idea of the writer in this garret or her garret by herself, working, needing silence to be inspired or whatever, it doesn't really apply in translation, because it really can't be done alone. And that, by its very nature, there's always two people talking. And the more people you get involved in, if you are interested in literary translation as a career, the better, the easier it's going to be for you. The more you're able to do that horrible thing which no one likes the word of, which is networking.
Schmoozing.
But the better you become at realising that the more conversations you have, the more fun it's going to be and the better access you're going to get. And the more you're going to hear about new books as well, the less disappointments you'll have, because there are books you fall in love with that you think that you're going to be the translator of, and then discover that someone's already translating them or signed up to translate them. Also, what Roz says, just to go over that, you know, the idea of speaking to a publisher, I think that's one of the things that I would say today to anyone who really is interested in becoming a literary translator, is not to think of them as gatekeepers or to think of them as people who are against you. And to remember that, you know, you are a professional if you behave professionally. And so you do your research and you approach them from a position of knowledge, because they probably don't speak that language, they probably can't read that book. They probably can't read any literature about the author that you know is absolutely fantastic and having amazing response in their country of origin. And they'll never have access to it, you know, and that makes you an expert and someone that's very valuable to them.
Yeah, and if we change that word networking to two people having a conversation who have the same goal in mind.
Exactly.
Both of whom have different expertises, but they're working towards that same idea of bringing good writing into English.
Exactly. And
so
you just do it in another language.
No.
And also to think of networking, you know, take away, to stop it being a verb, but actually just think about how beautiful it is, the idea of actually there being tributaries of knowledge and information and languages. You know, it's what organisations like PEN do. They create networks, not just doing it.
Can I say something about networks? Is it all right, Tanta?
Okay, so because I'm not in charge.
Okay,
you are.
Happily not.
You are.
But the having, I think it's been, because I started out as a novelist, so we went into translation about 15 years ago, and I have witnessed this transformation of the translation world because of the kind of networking that happens. It's not about trying to get what you're after. There's so much generosity. So the people who are actually the best networkers in our translation world are the ones who are most generous. Mm. And an example is Daniel Hahn, who is donated his prize money for this new prize. He knows everybody. He does a lot of, you know, he does a lot of deals and so on. But it's the reason why everybody knows him is because he's always creating opportunities for other people. And it's particularly the new and emerging translators who've made all the difference Yes?
Yes, and the ETM is
being
a
very
great
honest,
example
that's
of that. Rosa's ETM is such a good example of that too,
yeah.
It's the Emerging Translators Network.
So that's an invention, like your invention.
So modern.
So there's a network that I created with a couple of other, well at the time we were early career translators, we can't call ourselves that now, mid-career translators. When we set it up, we described ourselves as the forgotten child stars of literary translation. we'd each had one book out and then nothing happened for ages. So we set up this network, the idea of which was to give early career or emerging translators a chance to network, to communicate with each other, even though they were based across the UK and around the world. And a chance to ask the kind of questions that, as a translator, you don't often get to ask until you've joined a professional organisation known as the Translators Association, which is a subsidiary of the Society of Authors, but which you can't join until you have a contract to translate a book. So obviously,
it's
if
too
you're
late.
Just
sorry, it's too late.
By that point, you've made loads of mistakes.
Yeah.
So you want to get in there early when you're just sort of dabbling in a few short stories, a few poems, before you get to that stage. You can join the ETN, and it's essentially just a Google group. It's really nothing whizzy, but it's amazing at what it does. So it's a forum, an online forum. People post questions, they post offers of work, they ask very specific questions about, you know, I'm translating this book and I need to find a way to express the subjunctive when somebody's talking about how doubtful they are about going to a party, but English doesn't have a subjunctive, how might you do this? It's wonderfully nerdy. But then also really practical questions. So who is going to the London Book Fair? Would you like to meet up for a beer? That kind of thing. It covers what's that about practical? So it covers all bases. And the idea also is that it acts as a kind of informal funneling organisation towards the TA. So we remind people constantly that joining the TA is what they should be doing, because one of the many benefits that it provides is a contract vetting service,
which on its own is more than
worth the membership money.
Yeah.
You want the expert eyes at the TA to look over your contract.
And
then
they train you up
so you can become very good at spotting how you're being screwed over.
They also chip in with another great thing of the TA that's not the contract service. They also offer sort of events, and one of those events, which is very cheap, you pay nothing to go and have a kind of 4-hour course with a great accountant who looks after the famous writers and translators accountant, or main writers, but we say and translators. And they give you this incredible course on how to do your tax return, and you know that saves you loads of money. So however much you think, I think it's £70 or something to join the TA, or £80 a year.
But there's a lower student rate as well, which might apply for some of you.
But you know, the ETN, to join the ETN before the TA, because you have to wait for that first contract, is invaluable.
And if anyone wants to join, you can have a look at our very basic website, which is just emergingtranslatorsnetwork.wordpress.com, and it has a list on there of criteria that you need to fulfil. You then email via the website, and all you need to join is, you have to fit those criteria, which are to demonstrate in some way that you have an interest in and or experience of literary translation, and you have to have a Gmail account. It's the only criteria. So if you'd like to join.
Do you have an age restriction? Or
you can't join, Maureen.
Okay.
That's what there is no age restriction, because one of the lovely things about translation is that people come to it at all ages.
We've got
members who are, you know, 18 up to 80 and probably beyond. Mm-hmm. People who have worked for years in other industries or as non-literary translators and then want to move into literature. So there's a real wealth of different kind of experiences
there. They're
at the beginning, So you can emerge at any age.
Blossoming the Translators Network.
Yeah, that would have been better. it does make it sound a bit like chrysalises.
I'm going to do the same as Ros, pass around some books, and then I'm going to, rather than explain kind of how I got into literary translation, I will explain the life of this book, which was my first published translation, just for variety. I'll pass them around in a sec, but I did English at university and went to Spain for a year as an Erasmus student and began to learn Spanish and then carried on learning Spanish and did a master's in comparative literature and lived with Spanish people and my language was pretty good and I loved literature, but it just never occurred to me to put the two things together and that there was this thing called translation. And until I read Margaret Joel Costa. Has anyone heard of Margaret? She's been here before. She is a translator from Spanish and Portuguese, and she's very famous. She's a great granddame, very lovely. And yes, she. I was I cheated basically in my MA. I was reading all of the works of one author called Jaime Marías in Spanish, and I was running out of time. I needed to read all of his works or whatever, so I read some of the English because I couldn't wait for them to come from Spain, or I was quicker at reading.
That's what I tell my students not to do.
Yeah, that's why I said it was cheating. It's not the right thing to do. But I read it and I realised that having read a lot of this author and going then suddenly to read this translated version of him, I couldn't tell the difference when I was reading. I couldn't tell the difference between the original and the English, which sounds absurd. But it really was true. She'd captured for me his voice so absurdly closely that it was almost like alchemy. And they say a good translation is one you don't notice is in translation, but actually, if you're sort of looking, it's staggering. I don't know if any of you have ever had that feeling when you're reading a translated book of really being close to the original. But so that was how I thought about it. And I was working in publishing, and just by chance, I got hold of a book by a young Spanish author who must be kind of maybe thought 40 or something now, called Evandro Pila, and he's from the north of Spain. And this is his second novel, and it had brilliant reviews in Spain. I was reading a Spanish newspaper, the Babelia supplement of El País, and there was a review of it, and it said it was brilliant. And I thought, oh, brilliant, it's like 70 pages long, I can read that, you know, just to keep up my Spanish. And so I did read it, and I read it in about 4 hours, and at the time I was working at a literary agency, and reading the slush pile, they call it, the submissions pile, horrible name for it. And I was waiting to become the prodigy of this literary agency, thinking that one day I'd read the book that would be, you know, that would be brilliant, and that I'd have found it. And in fact, what happened was I read a Spanish book and decided to be a literary translator to leave the agency instead. But how it worked was this, and I suppose it's a lesson in tenacity, is that I'd never translated anything before. I didn't even do Spanish at university. I had maybe translated a couple of poems that I loved of some old Spanish poets. And from my master's, I'd marvelled at Margaret Joel Costa's translations, but I'd never done anything myself. And I just started translating it. And then I thought, well, what could I do with this translation? And I'd have very little of it translated, maybe 10 pages. And I wrote to the agent. So it helped being in the profession of publishing, which is another point I'd like to make to anyone who would like to become a literary translator, is that you can't hide and just translate. You have to understand how the business of translation works in order to get a step in. And I was lucky because I did have that side. So I wrote to the agent and said, I love this book. I have no idea about writing or anything. I just said, what's going on with it? And it would be so good to have it in English. And she said, your email has reminded me how much I love this book, because she'd already pitched it and no one had been interested in this one-off writer from Spain, which is often the response you get. So then you have to say, okay, well, if you think it's really good and I think it's really good, you have to sort of maybe have a bit of arrogance and say, well, it must be really good then. So I said, well, why don't you pitch it with my English translation? And so she did. And to cut a long story short, Pushkin Press bought the rights in English to this book. And so I remember writing a congratulatory email to the author and to the agent saying, I'm really pleased for you and congratulations and that's great news and see you, have a nice life. And they said, well, what do you mean have a nice life? And I said, well, you know, I'm not going to translate it for Pushkin Press, like it's Pushkin Press, you know. And then the publisher wrote saying, well, we liked your sample. And that, for me, that kind of just, I'll never forget reading that line and saying, no, we bought it because you've brought those 10 pages into English. And I thought, so I'm doing the alchemy now. And it was just this really exciting moment of that you don't have to be an expert, really. I mean, you have to be good. You have to get better, obviously.
But I think it's key that although you didn't study Spanish, you studied English. And one of the things we always try and reiterate about translation is that it is writing.
Yeah.
It's a form of writing.
Yeah.
I mean, I know translators who barely speak the language they work from. I shouldn't probably say that. But they write English really well. You know, they are writers.
And they read the other language really well.
They read the other language. Obviously, you have to read it.
Yeah, yeah. I think that, yeah, exactly.
But I think your skill and your dominance in the language you're working into is far more important.
Yeah, and then and Deborah's another good example of that. Deborah Smith, who you may have heard of, who won the Booker Prize a couple of years ago for her first translation again, and she hadn't been learning Korean for very long, and this just blew the minds of a lot of quite small-minded journalists. Mm. But yeah, it's true of many translators. But anyway, so in the end, very long story short, but I translated it, and that was, you know, that was lucky in many ways, but it was also due to a few factors that I think I've carried on doing and have continued to get more work, because if you think that you really love a book in the language, then there's often something worth, you know, there's often something worth kind of holding on to and thinking, like, why is this book so special? It must have something. I think a lot of people doubt that their opinion is worth anything, and that, well, maybe it's just my voice against a whole publishing company, but it's not against. They just have never heard of this author or this book.
There's so much that gets published that publishers do not have access to, and you have that access with the language. Yeah. So it's about sharing that knowledge.
But it's also paradoxically arguing not for yourself, as you do if you're peddling your own work, but arguing for a book you love. It's not always carried through to the author of the book either. It's the book that you love.
Who in here does translate as part of their degree, or has translated as part of their degree, or is what? And who has ever translated for fun at home? Yeah, so we've got an easy crowd. Maybe questions would be good too, just for things that we've covered.
Did you want to? You mentioned rights. I wondered how much people are aware of that aspect, foreign rights.
Maybe we should. That's the most important thing when you're getting started. Later on, people, publishers will approach you because they know how to get them. And but at the beginning, there's a lot of heartbreak. People will start working on something, and then they'll find out that they've been exploited for their samples or the rights were sold to somebody else a long time ago.
So what could have happened with that book is that I had done that sample by myself and gone and taken that sample and not spoken to this author's agent in Spain, who looks after his rights. That's essentially one of the major jobs of an agent, is to look after your rights throughout the world, but usually just trying to sell your books within the original language, original country origin. But so if I'd done it a different way, which I would say is the wrong way because you're more liable to kind of get disappointed, I would have taken my sample and gone and pitched that book around to publishers without having established whether or not the rights were available or who had the rights. Not only is this like you could have kind of opening yourself up to heartbreak because you realise that the rights are sold and another translator's already halfway through the translation, but it also stops you being disregarded at the first step from the English language publishers, because although I say it's nice for it to be thought of as a conversation and stuff, they also are our business and have limited time and resources to look at unlisted manuscripts. And so if you write to them and show that you and don't show them that you've understood that your responsibility is to make sure that this book is available for them to publish, then some do say, well, look, go away and do your research and come back to me with an actual offer, you know, as in with an actual possible book for me to spend the hour that it would take for me to read this sample. Because it's a real waste of their time and you're probably going to get blacklisted.
So you first need to figure out who holds those rights.
Who holds the rights.
And sometimes it'll be an agent, sometimes it'll be the publisher. Less often it's the author themselves, but it does happen. So it'll be making contact with, figuring out who holds those rights. Normally you write to the publisher and they will know you are, right, and see if you can find out who the foreign rights person is at the publisher and establish whether the rights have been sold or not. And then seek permission to try and find an English language publisher.
And sometimes you can find them at the London Book Fair.
Yes.
I mean, I'd say one of the best things you can consider doing if you want to try your luck in the world of translation is to go to one of the summer schools. There's also Arvine Foundation does one residency course about every 2 years. There are also mentorships. There's also, it's basically, if you go to the British Centre for Living Translation website or the English Pen website,
or the Translators Association web pages at the Society of Authors, they will link you into everything else. But whenever you're going to a summer school or you have a mentorship, or there are going to be lots of the we are going to use that, those opportunities while we're with you to give you everything, give you all this instruction and networks and so on. Well, and I shouldn't leave out the London Book, the Literary Translation Centre at the London Book Fair, because and also we have another one for English Pen, but we generally do 16 events, many of which are designed for emerging translators, and lots of publishers are there from all over the world. It's the funnest place at the London Book Fair, definitely the funnest place. So as you leave in a good mood, having met lots of people, and of course the other the strange thing did. So we can say these things, but you can basically get lots more information by just signing up for some of these events. The city, some schools, I think it's stopped.
It's not, it doesn't exist at the moment.
No. But we're looking for another home for it.
Yeah. I've got an example here of a programme from International Translation
Day. I have another one from this year.
Oh, from this year. This is from 2014. If you wanted to have a look at it, just gives you an idea of some of the talks and workshops that take place on that day.
And you don't have to be a translator or literature. Just be interested. It's such a good day, because there are also kind of talks vaguely related to translation that are fascinating, often run by Penn, actually. And another thing I was going to say just just because it segues in, is about money and translation and not working for free.
And that's part of the instruction.
Part of the instruction, that's what made me think of it. When you said instruction, I was like, this is a really good tip. Not just because you should be paid for what you do, but because, of course, we're not a union, but we're professionals working together, supporting each other as a sector, and to undermine that by not having at least looked into how much you should be asking for, how much you should be expecting to be paid, and the rate at which you should say absolutely not, find another person.
But it's also because it was basically around the Translators Association about 12, 13, 14 years ago that we started talking about that. And there had been previously in some quarters been an adversarial relationship with us translators whinging. I'm still good at whinging, though. You're not paying us enough, and the publisher is saying, well, we're not interested anyway, and so on and so forth. So it's largely Danny Hahn, who we mentioned before, and Alexander Buechler, and Amanda Hopkinson, and various people said, well, actually, we're all interested in the same thing, which is bringing more world literature, bringing more voices in. And so we're going to insist on being paid properly so we can have enough, so that we can actually give the publisher something good. But we're also taking responsibility to see it through all, we're being paid that rate, we'll see it through all the drafts. We might even, if you're nice to us, help you publicize the book. And so that the relations between translators and publishers is much better than it is when I'm wearing my other novelist hat, because it's not at all nice like that. So I think translators have a lot to teach everyone else.
I always say to students, it's fine to work for free when you're still a student, but as soon as you graduate, you're a professional, and you can start asking for proper money.
But you're offering, you're professional in every way. You can define what professional means, and I think that gives a lot of confidence to publishers, because they know they have an ally.
One of the things that will make people see you as a professional is if you charge the proper rate. If you undercharge, then instantly there's a suspicion, does she or he not value her own work? Are they just starting out? Whereas if you go in straight with the standard, it's the minimum rate, isn't it? No, it's not. I don't like to call it that.
It's the recommended observed
yeah. which some publishers may or may not be prepared to pay at some point and within the next 2 or 3 months.
But English Pen is very important in this because English Pen won't give those grants to the publishers. The publishers apply for those, you don't know.
Yeah.
But they won't give those grants unless it's a proper contract. Mm, and so those of us who are not getting Pen Awards, who are not even applying for them, can say, well, that's what, you know, that's what the going rate is. Mm-hmm. We have observed, yeah.
It really pushes the publishers to pay more because...
Well, pay properly.
Pay properly. But, so we've got 2 rounds a year, and I've only been a pen for a year, but in that time the TA recommended rate has gone up by £5. And I do send applications back to publishers and say, this is under TA recommended rate.
And they bump it up.
And generally the publishers want to know what the going rate is anyway, if they're idealistic like we are.
There's a lot more awareness around
Again, because of that sort of translators acting as a collective.
It's per 1,000 words, by the way, the rate. Well, in this country, in general.
Yeah.
And there are maybe some people who work it out slightly different, but it's
pages and things.
Well, poetry is different.
Poetry is different, obviously. Per line, but in general.
But that again is on the BCLT website, so.
And the Translators Association website as well.
And the English
Chantal, do you want to talk a bit about your experience as a translator and also Warwick and translation?
Sure. I was just going to say, one thing that Sophie said last year when we did this session before that really stuck with me is that when you're writing to publishers as an emerging translator, don't necessarily say, I'm an emerging translator or I've never done this before. You have to take that confidence, so the confidence that Sophie was talking about, that you think this book is great and other people do and therefore there must be something to it, take that into your pitch. So don't say, I'm just starting out, just leave that bit aside.
They don't need to know, they wouldn't if you were like a website designer, you wouldn't write, well, I graduated last year.
But also, in terms of, I mean, I'm not going to tell you how old I was when I went into translation. Not going to tell you, but I've published lots and lots of my own novels and lots of journalism and lots of essays and so on and so forth. So I would say my preparation for translation began when I moved to Turkey at the age of 8, because I was learning the language by myself by listening to it. It's everything I've ever read as part of my preparation for being a translator, and then everything I wrote. So you take whatever you have, you take into it. It's important to be confident about what you're taking, understanding and loving the other literature.
And you'll never be asked for a CV other than from Penn if you're if you're sorry for a grant, not us.
Publishers don't care about CVs.
And I think what you said about the publishers not having the language, that really kind of be stressed enough, because publishers also, They need readers' reports all the time for books they're interested in, but they don't have the language to read them. The blurbs, to read the blurbs, or to read the press, because most publishers only have English and maybe French.
And then when I speak to the editors we love the most, and I say, well, how do you find out about books?
By chance.
Well, they say it's at the drinks parties at Frankfurt, because they have certain... Germany's always ahead of us here, and France is not far behind Germany. And so they go to the interesting publishers in France and Germany, and they say, what are you reading? What would you recommend? Because they trust their judgment. And do you recommend emerging translators doing readers' reports, or is it...
If they're paid properly.
Because it's a good way of getting a... It's a good way of getting a good working relationship.
I know that, I'm not a translator, so... I've done a lot
in my time. I don't really do them anymore, if I'm honest. I mean, that's partly because I'm working.
You find them out.
But, it's a good way of getting your name on publishers' radars, that's for sure. I mean, it's not paid particularly well, but I think if you see it as a combination of a job to earn you a bit of pocket money and a way to get your name on a publisher's desk and make them aware of you and your ability to... write a synopsis of a novel, to persuade to persuade somebody of what it's doing as a text.
To justify, maybe
to justify it or not, you might not think it's written very well, and to be able to possibly make comparisons with other works in that language.
I think, and also
make them aware of your language combination as well, particularly if you've got a more unusual language combination, because that's what publishers are looking for more and more, is people with languages that they don't speak, but also which aren't really represented in the publishing scene in this country.
Yeah. And I do think it helps understand how publishers think and what the books they're looking for. And that can be, I think publishers are always actually really hungry for recommendations. Yeah.
And also to see publishers kind of, as people actually fight for books. And, and so you're working with publishers instead of against them. Mm-hmm. And I interrupted you.
Okay.
I did, not the first time. I'm a terrible boss.
That's all right. There are far worse bosses. I'll tell you briefly how I got started, and then I'll say a little bit about what kind of translation things we do at Warwick, and then maybe say a few things about what you can do sort of in between that first book contract, kind of how you can set out along the way without necessarily doing a full-length work. So I studied French and German at Cambridge. I went to Austria to do my year abroad, and then I went back to Austria to teach English for a couple of years, and then I ended up at UEA and did the same programme that Rosalind did, the MA in Literary Translation, and then once I had graduated from that programme, I started to send out pitches to publishers. And there wasn't, so this kind of infrastructure that's in place now, so the Emerging Translators Network, the London Book Fair, none of that existed when I graduated. It's a much, much improved situation now.
It was the Wild West.
It was the Wild West back in 2002. The situation for emerging translators has really changed. There's a lot more support out there now than there was when I was getting started. So I literally just, and this was also sort of pre-email, you know, and the digital age really sort of taking off, so it was really kind of brown envelope submissions to publishers, and that's how I started. I sent something out to an emerging publisher, which was the Chicken House. They'd just got started at that time. And that was Barry Cunningham, who had pulled J.K. Rowling out of the slush pile at Bloomsbury and then taken his money and set up his own publishing house. And they'd had a little bit of success publishing Cornelia Funke, who I'm sure many of you have heard about or read, and so they were kind of open to the idea that international children's literature might be a thing. And the sample I sent to them, they didn't like. It was too philosophical. Don't really do philosophical children's literature in this country, they told me. But then they took the next pitch that I took, so I was just lucky.
So you found another Cornelia excerpt?
I wasn't a Cornelia excerpt.
And then just
I
did the other one.
I ended up doing not quite a bit, but enough work for that publisher where sometimes I sent them things and they did them, and sometimes they commissioned me to do titles that they'd bought on their own initiative. And now I'm an academic, I don't have a lot of time to do translation on the side, but I usually always have one sort of freelance project on the go. But I'm obviously not as in the world as Sophie and Rosalind are. In terms of what we do with translation here at Warwick, we do a little bit of translation teaching at the undergraduate level. Don't know if anyone in here is taking the How to Read a Translation course. Yeah, I can see some faces. We have two MAs in translation, so we have one in the English Department Literary Translation Studies degree, and there are several students from that programme here. Modern Languages is relaunching its translation degree. It will have a new name next year. It used to be Translation Writing and Cultural Difference. I think it's becoming Translation and Cultures next year.
Important change.
Yeah. So there are those two programmes, and we have a PhD in Translation Studies as well in the English Department. What else do we do, Maureen?
Why don't you talk about your prize?
We have, some of you might have heard, we set up last year the Warwick Prize for Women in Translation, and that is to respond to the situation that Theodora mentioned, which is that far more men than women get translated. More men, male writers tend to be, so somebody come through. That's okay. That's fine. More male writers and female writers tend to make it onto prize shortlists, even though if you looked at The Guardian, I think today or yesterday, there's an article in there about the huge success of international women writers and how female writers in general are topping bestseller lists. So there are fewer female writers out there, I think both in English mm-hmm. and being translated from other languages, but they do much better than male writers. But the Warwick Prize is intended to get more female writers into translation, to encourage publishers to translate more female writers. And we did that for the first time last year. A very interesting book called Memoirs of a Polar Bear, when Yoko Tawada won. And we're doing it again this year for our sins. Yeah. We're doing it again. So the prize ceremony is pretty much open if people want to come along and you're still around. I know not everyone is here past the end of the academic year, but it will be in November.
Come back.
Come back. Yeah.
So yeah, you're welcome to come along.
Cheer people up. It was great.
Yeah. Nice prize. Yeah. Really good. So the prize came out, the TA prize, the one that Ros has been a judge on and mentioned, this first translation prize. There's some crossover books, which is really nice to see as well. What I mean is that some that got on the shortlist of the Warwick Prize for Women in Translation is also on this first translation prize. And you would, my mouth literally opened when I saw which books were on this list, because I had no idea that some of these translators were first translators.
I know, we didn't either.
They're so good.
Yeah.
I mean, one of them translated a Nobel Prize winner, so if that doesn't spur you on to the fact that you know that you can do it and that there is a way in, you just have to work lots and hard. And
yeah, but also love it, and also it helps to want to catch it, yeah, kind of bring the voice somehow artistically into the real life, into English.
Yeah, it's vital. Yeah.
Margaret, you'll close the trick.
To be the author.
Mm. Yeah.
So you guys.
Just to say a few things about the kind of things you can do between maybe coming out of a degree programme, whether it's your BA, your MA, your PhD, and trying to get into this world of translation. There are various competitions that you can enter. You don't need to be an experienced translator to enter them. Again, no one will ask to see a CV. There's the Stephen Spender Poetry Competition. One of the graduates, actually she's graduating on Friday, Deirdre McMahon, who graduated from the MA in Translation in the Modern Languages Department, she got highly commended in that competition. Last year now, we're into 2018. So that's one example. The John Dryden Translation Competition that you can enter. I'll pass around a piece of paper at the end because I have a list of links that I can send out to everybody. Pen America has a really good website with a list of journals that accept translated submissions. Again, you don't need to be super experienced translators to start sending things out.
Words Without Borders, have you included that one?
Words Without Borders, great online journal.
Take a look.
Asymptotes as well, which I'm sure there are actually some people at Warwick who are involved in that journal as well. I think we maybe have the British editor on the writing LA.
Who's into African Studies, isn't she? She does the name. You'll come to
me. Yeah, but any kind of literary websites that are interested in translation, journals that accept things, you don't have to translate a full-length work, you can translate a couple of poems, an excerpt from a text. It's a good way of sort of dipping your toe in the water and getting started. So I'll pass around a piece of paper when we're done. If you want to leave me an email address, I'll email out the links that I have. The other thing I would say, just to reinforce what everyone else has said, the Translation Centre at the London Book Fair is great. So if you want to go to London for the day, get yourself a ticket for the book fair, go and listen to the talks, have a wander around, soak in the atmosphere. It's a really good
way. What are the dates this year?
12.
It's the middle of April, it's usually.
12 to 14.
When is it?
12 to 14.
12 to 14. And you buy your ticket for free.
Yeah.
Oh, and one more thing. Sophia's here, right, Sophia? The various cultural institutions that are attached to languages, this is generally, but not exclusively, a Western European or a European thing. Things like the Goethe Institute, Cervantes Institute for Spain, they're all interested in helping translators and promoting translation. The Goethe Institute, for example, German's my language, so I'll give you this example. They produce a magazine called New Books in German, which goes out to publishers. It's basically a sort of digest of new books in German and English. Again, trying to make things easy for British publishers who don't speak German. Sophia, you're interning there, is that right?
Yeah, and wasn't that your previous place?
So I used to work there as the editorial consultant, and one thing they do apart from internships is also, they also run a translation seminar internship, practicum. and then now there's new books in Spanish as well.
There's new books in Spanish, yeah.
There's all kinds of, yeah, like you say, institutes. Because I also work for a cultural institute before that, so they're all interested in promoting more literature from their languages.
I would just add that the Institut Français also has a prize, the Burgess Prize, which is like encouraging. I think they pay for 30% of translation fees. So again, like encouraging publishers to like publish more translated works.
Yeah. So there are a lot of smaller, wonderful concerns that what is the agency that Raj Hortz runs? So it's basically for work in France, yeah?
Yeah.
So if you go to these gatherings, you will meet the people who are coming up with these new ideas, and you yourself will come up with new ideas.
So find your cultural institute, whichever languages you have. Not all countries have them. It depends which languages you're working with. But get on their mailing list, go to their events. If they do things like new books in German, you can write readers' reports for new books in German, for example. They don't pay very much money. You should tell them it's time to up their price. Yeah. But those kind of things kind of help you network and feel involved.
But also, Turkey doesn't have a Goethe Institute type of thing, but there are people who are very active in Turkey who work very hard for translation and world literature, and sometimes they're connected to the embassies, sometimes they're not, or sometimes they used to be connected to the embassies. But if you get into those networks, there's a wonderful summer school in Turkey, for example, for emerging translators. So just if you get involved in the and a lot of the embassies will help when a translation comes out. So getting involved in those networks is also a good idea. It leads to some awkward moments, yes?
Well, embassies.
The embassies.
Oh, it can be, yeah.
Well, yeah.
Depending on the
human rights situation.
Anyway.
Do we want to do some questions?
Yeah, I think we should.
Yeah?
Yeah.
So, yeah. Does anyone have any questions for anyone on the panel?
What do you think about sort of LinkedIn as a way to contact publishers or to receive commissions?
I've never used LinkedIn. I don't really know what it is. I mean, I get annoying emails from it sometimes, but I just don't read them.
I think meeting people face to face is actually quite important, and then electronica.
Face to face is at things like the London Book Fair. Involves taking a deep breath and going, "Hello, I'm blah blah blah," to a perfect stranger who you know is the publisher of a publishing company whose books you've read, and therefore then you think that they're absolutely amazing. It's really embarrassing, and
it also involves going to London, which isn't that easy for somebody. So it might be an idea, but I think it's better to contact the publisher directly, so rather than through LinkedIn. I mean, maybe that's how it works, I don't know. But if you can email somebody and say, "I'd like to meet you at the book fair," because they do get booked up quite quickly. Mm-hmm. So maybe, electronic contact first of all, and then setting up a meeting.
But then they have, when you go to one of the Literary Translation Centre's events, often the publishers will be on the panel, and you can speak to them afterwards.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And don't they have pitching? Do they still do pitching sessions for?
Not this year.
So that's quite good.
Yeah.
How long do you usually spend on like a translation sample, for example? Mm-hmm. I know it varies from book to book, but like a 10-page translation.
It would depend on the book and how difficult it is and the kind of work it is. As long as you can to make it the best sample that you can. Show it to people.
To friends to read.
Give it to friends who don't read the original language, so that they can read it as a piece of literature in its own right in English, and maybe they'll spot weird conjunctions or prepositions that don't quite fit.
It's the process more than the amount of time. When I do the first translate, the first draft, I feel in my own English a very heavy Turkish accent. Because I'm just thinking that way, and then I go let it sit, and then look at it again, and then it turns into something else the next day. And if I read it out loud, then all of the strange things kind of pop out, and you fix those up, and then you feel very good about yourself. Yes.
Yeah.
And when it starts singing, it's
pretty. If you have time, then at least 5 or 6 drafts.
Yeah.
But
also time between the drafts.
Yeah, time between the drafts.
Exactly. Yeah. I would only add as well that the process matters, sorry, just to finish that. It's the process matters in the sense that, I just can't stress enough, don't start working with a sample unless you know that book is... Unless you do it for pleasure, but don't do it with any expectations. Like, definitely find out if that book is still available to be published in English.
Also, when a translation comes to me, I'll spend the most time on the early pages, because that's the time when you're trying to figure out what the voice might become in English. Yeah, and so I'll go over and have many more than those graphs to talk about. And then once you have the voice, sometimes the voice helps you go faster.
Is there sometimes a risk that you're like never happy with the translation and you could think you could just keep redrafting and read, like, when do you know when to stop, sort of thing? Because I know I do it with essays and just can keep going forever and never be happy.
When you're late for to deliver.
And also then you
the deadline. But you're still never happy with it. Yeah. I mean, I've looked through these translations because I've used some of them in classes recently, and there's stuff that I think, I wish I hadn't done that.
Yeah.
Or students have come up with better solutions.
Oh, that was always that. That's not workshopping anymore. I was going to say, do go and read. It was really good. An article that Deborah Smith wrote this week. It came out this week in the LA Times. It's free, it's online. It's really, really good to explain that process of it not being finished, of it being collaborative, of it not being a perfect.
But also, I mean, a good thing to remember about translation is that other people can do it. You know, it's not like writing these.
Yeah.
And so if people don't like it, they can go, they can sit the hell down and do a better job.
Yeah, exactly.
So, in other words, there's an awful lot of diversity of opinion about, especially in a culture that has a really, really narrow idea of what a translation should be. As some do. So you're sort of, you hand it over and then you wait to be thanked, admired, and
criticized. And you can't please everybody all of the time.
By the way, I'm an Orientalist, just so that you know, because I have so many papers written about me as an Orientalist. because I am, because I'm translating from, you know, a marginalized language, from the Eastern Mediterranean, into English. That's a definition of Orientalist.
Yeah.
I'm not going to put it on my visiting card.
Wait, slash Orientalist.
Yeah.
And you have a Turkish carpet in your office.
Haram, did you have a question?
Would you say it was easier or harder to translate to or from sort of less spoken languages?
That's
one for you.
It looks harder, but at the end of it, after more than a decade of complaining about how much harder it was for me, I've come around to the idea that actually I have an easier time of it, going from Turkish to English, because it forces you quite fast to thinking, what is the essence of this thought? You know, what is the voice? You know, what's going on here? Whereas I think if you're not, you know, if I'm translating from French, for example, which I also have done, I just get into, you know, I catch the wave, and then the wave is really Spanish. Yeah. We have lots of words that end too long. Yeah. Okay. So I think it's different, and it's actually it's also the grammatical structures that cause me the most trouble, because for speakers of Turkish, English is backwards.
Sophie and I do very easy
languages.
We do. They just think they are.
Chantal's slightly harder.
Just to add to that, wearing my theoretical hat, there's the issue of what we call directionality in translation, which is certainly in English we have the assumption that you translate into English, into your mother tongue, if you're a native speaker. And very often sort of contracts might stipulate that, or there's a general kind of code of ethics among translators, that's the way things work. That is shifting slowly.
I thought you were going to say shit.
So you have people actually translating into a language that isn't their mother tongue, and that tends to happen with sort of what we call smaller languages. That sounds
community languages. Yeah. They also get called, which is possibly worse.
I think it's good that that's shifting, and it reflects. I mean, certainly speaking only kind of on the sort of EU level, the fact that within the EU happily, this might be about to come to an end, hopefully not, but so many people move around for educational purposes that it's actually no longer very easy to define what people's mother tongue is. Yeah. You might have a language of education, a language you speak at home, and therefore people do feel comfortable perhaps translating into languages that are not their mother tongue, and I think that's to be welcomed,
yes.
Actually.
And it's partly because of, you know, we here in the UK have a very narrow idea of linguistic diversity. Mm-hmm. So few of us speak other languages, so sadly, that it's your, you know, you have a mother tongue and then not the mother tongue.
Yeah.
But that it's becoming harder to define what that is. I mean, one of the members of my ETN network is a translator from the Kurdish. He is Kurdish, and he's just recently translated the first ever novel to be translated from Kurdish. But he worked at the BBC for many years. His English is almost impeccable. I mean, it is impeccable. But as Sophie was saying earlier, it's not a solitary process. So he had an editor. Mm. He had a proofreader. He had a copy editor. Lots of people worked on this text. Mm.
And we have, traditionally, in the sort of our writing program here, we've welcomed students from other languages. And they'll come sometimes with, you know, because they've been educated, so you can't tell the difference, or sometimes they have a bit of a way to go. But what we've noticed is if they stay with us for the year, they are actually, they're not writing in impeccable or wonderful English, they're writing in their own English.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So it's they're writing creatively. And I think after they can do that, they can do anything. They can, often they'll come to us because they want to skip the translation track, but if we do our job right, they're writing in both languages and between languages.
Mm-hmm.
But that's the way the world is now.
Yeah, and translation, well, writing is making words anew, making words seem new and fresh. Translation is an extension of that, and if you're writing from something which is maybe not what we would narrowly call your mother tongue, your native tongue, then you're making new decisions, you're bringing new ideas into English, you're writing creatively.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So, translation is writing.
Yeah,
because often translators, I think 15 years ago, they would say, I'm just a translator, I'm just a technician in the background, and so forth. But it's very much changed around, so especially since translators are reading so sort of passionately in their other language. Mm-hmm. Yeah?
I think we had a question at the back there.
Yeah, I was just going to ask, when it's at this sort of editing stage, when possibly commissioned by a publisher, how much input do you generally have? Is it kind of editors tend to sort of want you to collaborate with them in a way,
I think it depends on the publisher
and
the relationship you have with them. I've always had very, apart from one, very good experiences of being edited. It's a really nice experience.
It
if
is.
You have a good editor, it's wonderful to have somebody analyse your work that closely and collaborate on a text with you. It can be really rewarding. I mean, some of the best solutions in novels I've translated have been collaborative decisions made between me and an editor.
Solving
me
things together.
Definitely.
Yeah, me and co-translation in that same way. Mm-hmm. You can, in an insoluble problem, you can sort of, talk through your Skype screens and complain, and then the solution will come up.
Yeah.
Lots of complaining being talked about.
I would say translate together too. You know, you're both interested in translation and you've both worked from the same language. Like, I wish someone had said that to me earlier. I was a bit of a lone wolf, and it didn't make me a better translator. I just started doing co-translation, so I did it the other way as you. And now I'm doing three in one go, and I just don't know what I'll do with when I can't work with someone now.
There's a lot of bad practice out there. So there's a university, American University Press, approached me and said that they were going to do a novel by Yashar Kemal, an old novel by Yashar Kemal, and they were going to farm it out to five different translators. That's bad.
Yeah.
That's bad. And then they said, the editor will be able to even things out. No. And then I've been approached now. There's this famous book, a book in Turkey that we're buying a lot, and it's by an imprisoned leader of a Kurdish Democratic Party, and it's called Seher by Selahattin Demirtas. And so the sample was done by an agent and a former kind of student of mine there, she just needs some mentoring. But they actually came to me and said, could I do it instead? But solidarity. So I'll just mentor.
Mm.
But if you're in those networks, you're more likely to see how they're doing people over.
Yeah.
And one of our responsibilities, if we are established, is to give support to them.
Yeah.
Especially if they don't need very much.
I think it might be useful to mention that that editing process is part of the thing that is factored into the fee that you get.
Yeah.
So what the fee that you get is per word or per thousand word, but also there's lots of extraneous work that you do as a translator. That might include the editing, which might take weeks, and you aren't paid for the editing per se.
But it's fun.
It's fun, yes, but you know you need
you
to
need
eat
to
as
add
well.
It up. Yeah, you need to add it all.
You need to know that that's part of the fee.
And I've just been asked, for example, by a publisher who shall remain nameless, to take part in a questionnaire between me and the author for them to feature on their website. And it's a lot of extra work, and I'm going to say no.
But on the other hand, there's a kind of translation of an old classic called Madame in a Fur Coat. The author was assassinated in 1948, I think, and so I was one of the co-translators. And the other co-translator was having a bad hair day, week, month. Okay, so when it came out in the US a few months ago, I just felt I had to do everything. You know, I just wrote and gave endless interviews. I was paid for nothing. They hadn't even sent me a copy of the book. But I felt I was doing it for the author. And I can because I have a uni job. I think that's the thing. So sometimes you do agree to these things.
Sometimes you can.
It's just exploitation.
You have time. But yes, it's important to think about that fee and what it includes in terms of extra work.
Rebecca, could I do two plugs before?
Yeah.
So just to say that we have a web page for all translation activities at Warwick. If you search for translation at Warwick, it's kind of cross school departments with sort of English and modern languages in them together. And we also have a Facebook page where I try and post anything about translation events going on here, but also in London and around the country. So like us on Facebook. The other thing is, tomorrow's Warwick Thursday. Mark Harris from Warwick Books is coming. It's an independent bookshop in Warwick Town Centre. It's a beautiful bookshop. Some of you have been there. Mark's coming to talk about independent bookselling, and that's also something, it's important to understand how bookselling works from a translator's perspective as well. So come and listen to Mark. She's great. They've only had the bookshop, I think, 5 years, her and a partner, and they're doing amazing stuff. And it's really hard to be an independent bookseller these days.
Yeah.
And they need
when Amazon is taking over everything. Yeah. So don't buy from Amazon. Buy independent. Come and listen to Mark tomorrow in Melbourne House 130. And I'll pass around a list if anyone wants to add their email address. I'll assume you're at Warwick AC UK unless you signal otherwise.
Okay, can we just say thank you to everyone for giving up their time to come and talk to us? Like I said at the beginning, if you want to sign up and become a member of English Pen, please sign the thing just here, and then hopefully we can do more literary related events, or you can also suggest the kind of events that you'd like us to put on, so please do get involved, and thank you so much for coming. Yeah.
And thank you, Rebecca.
No, I didn't do anything.
Thank you.